everyone. I'm Justin Chisholm, welcoming you to this fifth and final episode of the Yacht Racing Podcast Extra for March 2021. My guest this time is New Zealand sailor Ray Davis, a key member of the Emirates Team New Zealand syndicate that earlier this month, of course, successfully defended the America's Cup on their home waters off Auckland, New Zealand. As well as being instrumental in introducing the original concept of a foiling monohull that so successfully evolved into the astonishing AC-75s that the teams raced in the 36th America's Cup, Davis was also in charge of Team New Zealand's sailing program, including driving the team's chase boat in mock match races to help hone Peter Burling's pre-start tactics. We chatted for about an hour, in which time I quiz Ray about how the AC-75 concept first saw the light of day and how it subsequently evolved into a high-performance match racing boat, the various design paths taken by the four teams with their AC-75s, how the AC-75 rule might evolve now for the next edition of the America's Cup and beyond, the challenge of attracting more teams to the America's Cup. We also talked about how Davis saw the 36th America's Cup match play out from his vantage point on the Team New Zealand chase boat, and how he and the rest of the team tried to make each day just another day on the water. As well as all that, I also asked him about the timescales for finding out more about the format of the 37th America's Cup. Well, Ray Davis, welcome to the Yacht Racing Podcast Extra. And let me start by saying very hearty congratulations on Emirates Team New Zealand's defence of the 36th America's Cup. Congratulations. How does that feel?
Yeah, thanks, Justin. Oh, look, honestly, it feels pretty amazing. It's been a lot of hard work, as you can imagine. And look, this one's been just incredibly satisfying. Feels a bit different to Bermuda, and obviously very different to San Francisco and Valencia. So it's been good. It's been an amazing journey with the team, but to have won or defended back in New Zealand is it's really topped it off, actually.
Now, we last spoke I think back in December of 2018, and you were already into the preparation for this this 36th America's Cup. And at the time you were telling me about this, the work that you'd done to start talking about the AC-75. You were pretty integral in bringing that to fruition, weren't you? Can you tell us a bit about how that AC-75 foiling monohull came about?
Sure. It basically started, I guess, initially back in 2016, the meeting around my kitchen with Guillaume Verdier and another local guy who was wanting to build a boat to get the Coastal Classic, sort of a coastal race in New Zealand. He said, look, I don't care about the rules, I just want to be the fastest monohull there. And so that sort of was a clean blank piece of paper for that meeting. And I was basically saying to Guillaume, I said, look, you're a mocker, so they're pretty good boat. They're probably the fastest offshore coastal type boat, but that keel is absolutely, it doesn't know if it's Arthur or Martha. It doesn't know if it's giving stability or riding moment half the time. So you've got to just get rid of that. If we get rid of the keel, it'll really go like the clappers. So that was the conversation that began, and we started scribbling a few ideas down on a bit of paper. And then Guillaume went away and did a bunch of studies on it. And his office sort of came back and said, look, this is all doable. And that was the beginning of the conversation. We just kept working through and did a set of drawings. But then we went to Bermuda and were successful up there, and we talked to that owner. I said, look, don't rush into this project, see what happens with the America's Cup. And sure enough, we went down that path, and the America's Cup's done obviously took that initial concept and we presented that to Team New Zealand. And obviously prior to, we were also involved in the discussions around what type of foiling monohull we should go for. And there's obviously, there's a myriad of different options as soon as you're going to say you want to try foil a monohull. And there's some pretty crazy concepts got sort of tested on the simulator. And as it all turned out, the Team New Zealand designers all basically got behind this concept as well out of probably about a dozen sort of options. And yeah, sure enough, we ended up with basically the same sort of concept. So it's been incredibly satisfying to see that initial sort of style of boat get a, you know, make it all the way through to the America's Cup. And yeah, once it got in the hands of the America's Cup design teams, it got taken to a whole nother level. And we knew it was always going to be a boat we could race around the track, but then I think it probably exceeded even my expectations, which I, you know, had pretty high of its boat handling ability and the actual way we could match race the boat in the end, bringing that whole dimension of, you know, the history and of the cup, of one-on-one proper match racing back into it. And obviously, high-performance boats are hard to match race at the best of times, but when we get it into some puffy, shifty conditions and things are changing pretty dramatically, it makes for incredibly entertaining racing. So it looks like it's going to be around for a while in the America's Cup too now.
Well, it does. And of course, now we know that the proof of concept works, that these boats are incredible and they do deliver what we want from them. But going all the way back to when you kind of threw the design on the table or put it up on the screen and said, well, I think, you know, this is worthy of consideration. Were there a few skeptics in there, a few people scratching their heads? Did you have to do a bit of convincing?
Oh, yeah. No, there's plenty of skeptics. I think I threw the drawing down on Dolce's table and said, look, this is what I think. And then there's a whole lot of different options and some less radical versions, obviously, with traditional canting keels, etc., which obviously we know that works, but hopeless for match racing. And it just took a little while. What we're very fortunate at Team New Zealand, as we do, as I'm sure all the teams have now, is a simulator that can, you know, put whatever you want into it, and then you can give it, you know, a test with all the sort of physics, the real physics going on. And, there's always a bit of tuning involved and you've got to question it at times. But once we felt we'd sort of got a bit of reality coming out the backside of the simulator, it all made sense, you know. It was doing what you thought it should do. And then when you can use it in a tool like that, then the designers, etc., and sailors can look at it and it starts making sense. You know, you have a lot of questions when you first discuss this sort of a concept, but until you can actually see it sailing, and you, I think for sailors that makes it a lot easier rather than it just being all theoretical. And there was a bit of pushback from Prada and Team New Zealand on this concept. But once we started playing with it, it all suddenly made a heck of a lot of sense. And obviously it took the sailing world quite some time to get their head around it also. And I think in the end there's been fairly unanimous buy-in that it worked well.
Were there any compromises built into this design, into the concept that you have had for it as a result of Mr. Bertelli's desire to return to a kind of conventional monohull? Because I think, like you do hear this a lot from America's Cup fans, they want to see spinnakers being pulled down, they want to see sail changes, they want to see crew work on the boats. So how much of that kind of got fed into the design? Because I know the head sails had to be thrown off winches and that sort of stuff. That may be something that you wouldn't have necessarily built into the design.
Yeah, sure. No, there were a few, I guess compromises is possibly the word, but no, look, honestly, Mr. Bertelli and Prada were awesome as far as, working together on this final rule and concept. There's a lot of backwards and forths, but from our side as well, we wanted it to be a boat for sailors where you potentially are pulling, or we thought we would be pulling sails up and down. We had a light air sail that we were ready to pull up at any stage during the America's Cup. So we were ready to pull sails up and down, but as it turned out, your sails just keep getting, as the boats were getting faster and faster and the foils were getting more and more efficient, teams were just requiring less and less sail area. We obviously got caught out with the wrong jib in that very light air race where we dropped off the foils, but that was our J3. So even though we're caught out with one that was a bit too small, it wasn't the end of the world for us. So it was remarkable actually how little sail area you're required as soon as you're up and foiling. So all of the teams had, the code zeros and tested those at length to see where the crossover would be. And they had a bit of a home downwind, but it was hard to really make them efficient upwind as soon as you're foiling. So they end up being very, very flat. And there's a tiny, tiny window where, they were probably okay, but it wasn't worth the risk of committing to those type of sails. So unfortunately, I guess for the viewing side of things, that meant we weren't seeing sail changes. And yeah, I guess the other one you mentioned is the winches on the jibs to make them, so the crew are actually trying to do things in a somewhat traditional sense. Yeah, that was a rule that was added as well. Other than those two, there wasn't too much. There's a self-righting rule in the 75 as well, so that's why all the keels were, sorry, the well, keels or foil arms were so solid with all steel or lead. So they were all made to a rule weight. So, when the boat capsized, it was not going to turn turtle. But in reality, you're pulling your chase boat in there straight away and hooking up a rope and assisting with righting the boat anyway. And depending which way the boat capsizes, the wind's either assisting or not. So that's possibly an area that could be reviewed in the future to make the boats a little bit lighter and get a quite a bit more performance in the light airs out of them. But other than that, I'm just trying to think on the fly. There's not too many compromises. It was pretty much we had to commit for high performance with these type of boats, hence the double skin mainsail, and had to get as much performance out of them as possible for the concept to work. It's pretty hard to compromise a foiling boat, otherwise it just turns into a dog real quickly.
Would a solid wing like the AC50s have been a consideration at any point?
A lot of people have talked about it. The issue with a solid wing is you can get caught out and you can't get rid of it. You can't reef. So then you're in a situation you could be out there in 25 knots with a solid wing up with a boat that inherently doesn't have a lot of stability unless it's going forward. So it's actually a high risk option and would be a complete shocker. Yes, the boat would perform a little bit better with a solid wing, but you'd just blow over if you got caught out in breeze, whereas we could always just drop the sails like a normal monohull when the breeze got a bit fresh. At least with the catamarans, you can kind of manage a wing when there's quite a bit of breeze around. You've got a lot of stability at low speed, so you can accelerate and bear away and deal with a wing come what may, pretty much, until that point that always arrives at some point where it's a bit unwieldy. But with a monohull, it's not really an option. A lot of people talk about that as how cool would that be. And yeah, there's benefits for sure from a sailing perspective, and maybe a long-term cost saving even, because you're not having to replace sails. But it just doesn't work from a practical point of view. You'll end up just blowing over at some point, and no good. Shocker.
Understood. Now, these AC-75s were designed and the concept was validated kind of 100% on the computers of the design teams. There were some surrogate boats around, but fundamentally, when we saw these, the full-size boats up and foiling for the first time, I think we all gave a little bit of a sigh of relief that these boats kind of worked. But has this changed the way that performance racing boats are going to be designed now? Is this a kind of landmark moment in design and construction?
Yeah, I think so, 100%. The tools are incredible now, and they've all been refined through the latest couple of America's Cups. So you have confidence in those tools, which was something that we haven't had until the last, few years. And those tools still need more and more work all the time as we learn more about these boats. Well, it's all a refinement really now. But I've done quite a bit of work with the Volvo and the Super 60 design, and that was all run through the simulator as well. So I think for all of those types of boats now, a lot of the mockers are all sort of tested on some sort of a simulator, just to get a feel. It's a quick and dirty way of what it's really good for is it gets the yachties, the sailors and the designers in front of the same computer, so you can kind of talk and have a conversation about various aspects of the boat in a very easy way. Like you can say, what about this characteristic that's happening here, whereas a sailor might try and describe that situation to a designer, and it could easily get lost in translation. But with that sort of tool, the conversation both ways can be explained a lot easier. And I think that's one of the gains we've found in the last couple of editions of the Cup, is once you've got the designers and sailors in that same room, it's really good for the chat to get on the same page. Especially with it's a lot of different languages happening around and accents, so it's quite good to have a common visual happening. Yeah.
Now, the Defender and the Challenger, they had a few months head start on the other challenging teams, on the other two teams. And we saw, certainly when the first tranche of AC-75s were launched, we saw them grouped. Your boat and the Italian's boat were not dissimilar. And I guess the other two were not like yours. That's probably the best way of saying it. Do you feel like there was a kind of significant head start from a design point of view? And is that why we saw the Challenger of Record in the final with you?
That's a really good question because, we sort of had the rule earlier, but we're still making the same sort of decisions, and there was definitely a bit of unknown about that fundamental difference of are you looking for stability from the hull while trying to take off and accelerate, or is there enough stability generated from the foils, and how much do you need to worry about that real downspeed moment when there's inherently not a lot of stability? And that's a big question mark. And it was just how much risk you're prepared to take. And, we had a head start from a design perspective, but, the other teams had their first test boats in the water. I can't remember how long in months. But it was, Jesus, it felt like about a year. They were actually sailing around their test boats a long time before we had anything in the water that vaguely resembled what we ended up with. But yeah, we were just having to rely on the tools, and that's, you know, that doesn't fill you with all of the confidence in the world. Look, we knew the tools were amazing, but we really had to trust them in that situation. So yeah, we had our sort of head around the concept a bit more, but we had never seen it in reality. So there's, you know, there's that usual America's Cup situation where there's quite a lot of risk involved in some of these decisions, but you've got to throw the ball out there and back your sailors and designers to make it doable. And yeah, we certainly went down a path where we felt we didn't need a huge amount of stability, which would give us a more slender hull to accelerate through that. Sort of once you've initially got going up to sort of 8 knots of boat speed, somewhere around there, then you start getting fairly significant righting moment from the foil and the water. And then you could use that to really keep accelerating with a very small amount of wetted surface drag from the hull. And yeah, that concept clearly ended up being the way to go. And it's interesting, obviously, along the way, talk to my mate Dino from the American Magic, and their first test boat was a modified MC38.
Yep.
And yeah, the hull shape of that was, you know, plenty of volume there, and yeah, we'd always have a bit of banter on the phone, and he'd give me a hard time about these boats and the light air and how they're absolutely hopeless, and you reckon the conventional MC38 would beat it around the track, and yeah, so it was a bit of banter in the early days. But yeah, so it was good to have got through and out the other side of that, and you know, certainly in the light air, these boats are actually just phenomenal. Yeah, and there's plenty more potential there in the future as well.
How disturbing was it when you got information back from the spies who were watching the other teams about their boats? I guess you would pore over that information, would you, and just try and work out whether somebody got a jump on you?
Oh yeah, no, that was it's always pretty fascinating for sure. And look, the thing, I'm sure everyone listening to this podcast, you know, you think from the outside that, you know, your spies and the quality of videos and all the rest of it, that you'd have an incredible understanding of your opposition. But that one variable, the wind speed, is the one that just, one knot of wind can relate to nearly 4 knots of boat speed. So it's really, really tough to still, with 100% confidence, know how you're going against your opposition. So with, for example, there's a stage there when we had a quiet time that I went up and watched American Magic in Pensacola while Glenn Ashby went to Cagliari to look at the English and the Italians when they were both there. So we wanted to go with our own eyes. We saw the footage from the recon guys, but until you're there sort of seeing it yourself, it was hard to really know how they looked. So yeah, it was always pretty nerve-wracking, and it was really cool to see their test boats get launched initially and see them up and flying. And you know, that was a pretty good buzz when we first saw that happening. It was a shame it wasn't us with a little test boat first, but we went down a path that we gave ourselves a lot more time to do a better version of the test boat, and that, as it all turned out, was definitely the way to go for us. But you know, as sailors, we want to get out there and in amongst it as soon as we can. But yeah, it was back to your question. It was it was pretty nervous times looking at these other teams ripping around and trying to gauge how we were going against them on the other side of the world.
From the outside, it felt like that decision to build a test boat, to build a scale version of the boat, was a bit of a change of strategy from you guys. Is that fair to say, or was it always the plan to build one? You're just going to do it later than everybody else?
Yeah, it was always the plan. There was a lot of talk to decide when we could fit it into the program and what we would use it for. We'd sort of got to a point that we'd made the decision that was going to be the boat. So we'd gone beyond trying to do a proof of concept type of boat. That decision was made. So then it was, okay, look, if we're going to do a test boat, let's use it as a development tool and actually do a boat that we feel we can test foils on and test the sail concept properly, rather than doing something to figure out whether the boat will work or not. So, no, for us it was the right move, and we tested a series of foils on that boat and, elevators, and we learned a lot about the aero package as well. So it literally just takes that long. And also, that boat is a really well-built boat, and we had a new design team. It was a good opportunity to test the design and build team. We had our own build facility for the first time ever in America's Cup in Team New Zealand's history. We'd always outsourced the build in the past, but we had that in-house this time around. So that small boat was another example to keep working through that process as we were moving into boat two as well. So, it just gave us another crack at doing a full production. So we wanted to go, and it all sort of made sense in the end to give it a good nudge and do it properly.
And again, from the outside, it felt like, and it looked like, the difference between your boat one, full boat one, and boat two was fairly marginal, whereas on some of the other teams, there was a big change from boat one to boat two. I guess the Italians, again, that they were more of an evolution than a revolution. That's what it looks like visually. What we can't see, of course, are all the control systems. But are you able to tell us at this stage now, was there a big difference between boat one and boat two?
For us there was. There's pretty significant gains in the aerodynamics of it. Once it was flying, it was a more efficient shape, and it was much better in the lighter air takeoffs as well. So there was gains there, and all of the teams clearly made pretty significant gains. Probably Bar Prada, where they very much went and down the same path with both their first boat, as you said, and clearly American Magic and Ineos took a fairly large departure from their first boats, made significant gains with their second boat. And for us as well, it was we waited as late as we possibly could to launch our second boat. We thought with our build, we had a pretty efficient production line back here in New Zealand. So when we finally stopped designing that boat, it was probably quite a bit later than the other teams, so that we had just a bit more time to keep refining and learning and modifying from the on-water testing as well. So, I think we just saw a boat that was probably just a bit more advanced with a bit more time put into it. But again, this comes down to what sort of level of risk teams are prepared to take. And, it was pretty punchy, very punchy from the Ineos guys. I thought that was fantastic that they took such a step from where they'd been, from everything they'd seen before, to go to a boat that was so tender down speed, and to just back themselves and do their homework that would work. So they made a significant gain, and I guess they took a little while to sort out their foil package, but once they sorted that out and sort of tidied that all up, they were going much, much quicker, and their sales, they made some big gains towards the end. And it was just a testament to what we've always said, nothing's really changed in America's Cup. Until you're sailing in the similar patch of waters and sailing alongside people, even though we weren't allowed to do any coordinated testing, but you're out on the same patch of water and you get a feel of your performance, and you certainly see the sail setups in the same kind of conditions. So all of the teams learn a huge amount off each other once we're all sailing. So, yeah, it was great to see the INEOS team make the biggest gains in the last few months there.
Do you think the fact that we didn't get those two AC World Series events in Italy and in England, do you think that had a kind of damaging effect for all the teams? I guess it was the same for everybody, but they would have done a lot more sailing.
Yeah, sure. Oh, 100%. Yeah. No, definitely damaging. Yeah, it was, I think everyone was relying on those events to really ramp up the learning curve. And they were, obviously with the slowdown of COVID, et cetera, it was going to be quite ambitious to get to those events and in a race-ready configuration. But that was the rules, and everyone was scrambling to be there. So as soon as we were all together, I think it would have been incredible, the learnings. And, we all got there in the end, but it just would have all happened a lot earlier. So that was a real shame to have not had those two events.
Yeah, all
of the teams would have benefited from that.
For sure, and I think it's also a missed opportunity for the Cup itself and the sport of sailing, because I think it would have got people really fired up and interested in what the designs are, just in the same way that we talk about Formula One as a comparison a lot of the time, and people, even non-technical people, get quite aerated about the different designs of their favourite teams. And I think we would have seen that in this Cup. People would say, "Oh, wait till you see our boat too. It's going to be amazing."
No, abs, you're dead right, 100% right. It's just the interest for the sailing community, and I think it would have, really got the interest going, for sure. I can't add too much more there. It was a real shame to miss out on those events, 100%.
Now, having done a full cycle of the America's Cup with these boats now, and it seems like the commitment is that these boats are going to be used again for at least one more cup, maybe two, what do you do with them now? What are the upgrades you would make to these boats? Is there anything you can talk about there? I've heard Ken Reed talking about smaller rigs to kind of reduce drag and that sort of stuff, but what's your view?
Yeah, we haven't actually had, honestly, we haven't had time as a design team to sit down and go through the new rule in any detail yet. But if you just had a list of things that potentially you could do there's a whole host of things how much of the self-righting rule you worry about, to, like you say, the winches on board, or do you go just the self-tacking jib, or do you stay with a double skin mainsail or not? Do you have a different rig size? There's a lot of, number of sailors on board. Do you stipulate numbers of grinders, or do you, it goes on and on and on. The rudder rule, do you stipulate a length? But I think each of them has a pretty solid debate one way or the other. So there's a lot of topics, bowsprits, a lot of topics, but talking on one of them, for example, the double skin mainsail versus single skin, a lot of people would just instantly think the single skin, just go to a single skin mainsail, it's so much cheaper, is the impression out there, and a bigger mast. But you know, when you go through the numbers, and I think the other teams, as the regatta went on, they realised, you know, the benefits of the double skin is fairly significant as well. So it's not a clear cut decision that you'd go to a single skin by any stretch of the imagination. The double skin mainsail is just so stable through manoeuvres and doesn't flap, and or you know, the boats just sail so much better. They're more efficient in the light air for taking off. So, you know, I think that whole process of what we do with the rule is going to take some time, not because we're trying to delay anything at all. It's just it does need to have a proper review. So, we'll work with INEOS on that as quickly as we can and get that back out to the teams. But I'd like to think that, in all intensive purposes, it's not going to be too different to what we have now.
What we're looking for is more teams next time around, isn't it? So I guess filtering into that, all of those conversations, all of those elements you've described is, you know, how can you make it viable for a new team to come along and at least be competitive their first cycle?
You're 100% correct. We want to see more teams. It's hard to know what the right number of teams is, but it would certainly be nice to see, you know, at least a couple more would be amazing. So I guess things there to reduce costs is limiting the number of boats teams can build. And then obviously there's the second-hand market for the boats that are there now, just to get people up and running. So then I think, you know, that'll significantly reduce the cost if there was a rule to only allow teams to build one more boat. You know, that would make a big difference for teams. And I think that's probably the obvious one. And then, yeah, all the other ones are sort of up for debate, so I can't really go into too much detail on other cost saving ideas. For sure, that's the intention.
Yeah, and I appreciate you going as far as you did with that, because I understand it's a delicate and confidential matter. So listen, let's move on to the cup itself and the final match. I want to talk a bit about your role this time around. Aside from the AC75 concert, what were your primary responsibilities once the whole shebang kind of moved to Auckland? What were you involved in there?
Yeah, pretty much day to day, just coordinating the sailing program, making sure we're trying to get the most out of the day. You know, just the scheduling and where we'd go around the Gulf to make sure we had the best weather, and making sure we're as efficient as possible on the water. And then, so that was kind of the day to day side of things. Just talking with the guys afterwards regarding performance of the boat, and working with the designers on the areas we can work on to feed into the next sailing day's testing. Very much just a sort of a performance coaching type role with the guys, just making sure we were going forwards and getting faster. Fortunately, we had amazing guys on the boat, you know, from the top there, Pete Burling and obviously Glenn and Blair, Josh and Andy, were the sort of main guys pushing the performance side of the boat. And Pete's a pleasure to work with in that sense. He's got a pretty clear opinion of what he wants on the boat to make it go faster. So it's more just, just getting everyone's thoughts, but sort of working with Pete and the guys to make sure we were just having a pretty clear list of objectives for the next sailing day, and just sort of kind of filter that through the team and keeping everyone on the same page.
Now, I remember you told me during the Cup in Bermuda that you kind of, while Pete and Blair were away doing their Olympic duties, you'd driven the boat in that campaign and in the previous campaign quite a lot. Did you get the chance to drive the AC75s this time?
Yeah, the boat won a little bit and the test boat a little bit. Again, it was just mainly when those guys were away. And, you know, it was our philosophy. It's probably different from the other teams. And but we were just making sure every moment we were on the water, it was about making the boat go faster and giving the guys on the boat as much time as possible. So we didn't want to waste too much time, you know, with a sailing school sort of scenario and trying to get too many people ready to cover, because we knew, you know, the chances of someone actually getting injured and not being able to sail was very, very slim. And had that happened here, then I would have had to step into a role on the boat. I probably would have swapped around a bit with Glenn, and I just had to make sure I could cover Glenn's role, basically. So, yeah, sort of ready to go if needed be, but fortunately that wasn't the case, and we were able to always put our best team forward, and that was, you know, that was our philosophy, is that it was a, you know, everyone's just got to do their bit in the best way to make sure we get the boat going as fast as possible, and yeah, that seemed to work.
My reason for asking is because you're probably one of the few people, other than the helmsman of each of the teams, that could comment on the difference between the boats we saw in San Francisco and then the 50 footers we saw in Bermuda, yeah. And now these 75 foot foiling monohulls. Can you shine any light on that?
Oh no, for sure. Yeah, no, look, a huge, huge difference as those boats all evolved from San Fran. Clearly that was a bit of a buzz back in the day there, getting the AC-72 foiling for the first time, and then that whole addition was pretty special for all of those reasons. Just a bit painful in the last few weeks. As Oracle, you know, made the significant gains there and did a really good job in the end there. But those boats were, they're actually pretty incredible boats. If you had to build one of those now, with everything we've learned about foils and aerodynamics, etc., etc., they would be unbelievable. Like, the performance you could get out of an AC-72 now would be pretty staggering. I'd blow those other ones away to the weeds. You'd be lapping them. But you know, it's all just it all takes time to learn these lessons. And then to go to Bermuda with the AC-50. Just a refined version and awesome boats to sail as well. They were, as everyone sees now, they're still incredibly high performance boats. But the thing with them, I guess the biggest difference between the 75 and the 50 is basically, dare I say it, that safety word. Where the 75s are actually a easier boat and somewhat safer boat to sail uprange, is our experience. Because you're basically, the reason there is you're always trying to foil as low as you can. And then so when you do a nosedive, yeah, we've had some significant ones, but you know the multi-hulls, when they nosedive, they just pierce and stop and pitch pole quite aggressively, and then you know it's quite a long way down from the high side as well. And so the capsizes we've had, and talking to the other teams when they've had their capsizes as well, is I guess obviously the American Magic one was pretty dramatic, and there's guys a bit on the leeward side not enjoying life down there. But other than that, it's sort of a slow motion. The final stage of it, the boat just slows down so much as it's capsizing. So you're not really sort of coming to a grinding halt quite as aggressively as the catamarans do. So from that point of view, you know, we felt we could push these boats pretty hard uprange. And even if you capsized, it was, other than getting the water and the electronics, you could pretty much light the boat and shake yourself off and away you go again. So that's, you know, that's one of the biggest differences. And then from a, you know, just from a physical sailing perspective, but then as we saw, like the performance of the 75 is fairly is significantly better as well, across pretty much across the wind range. Once it's up and foiling, it's just less aero drag and very, very manoeuvrable. So your gains there as well. So pretty happy. It's then a step in the right direction, and then to be able to just pull into a marina and tuck the fours under in the future when, you know, hopefully there's get a class of these sort of boats going. You know, the issue with any of these foiling, high performance foiling boats is you need flat water. You really, really need to search out flat water. So the venues you go to are key. So long as you got flat water, the boats are, you know, very manageable. It's just they get pretty unwieldy as soon as you get into waves. So yeah, look, in the future, I think, you know, so long as you're choosing the right venues, you could get a class for these type of boats going at some point.
Fantastic. That's an exciting prospect. Ray, I want to ask you about driving the chase boat against Pete Burling for match racing practice. And there's talk that it was, you know, I understand why they would choose you to do that, but there's also talk of an AI bot, and, you know, that was kind of feeding the information. How did that all work? Can you talk about that at all, or is that still top secret?
Secret squirrel. Oh, no, look at I think all the teams were starting to do a bit of that in the end, with using the chase boat. you're just trying to create the same sort of situations that you're likely to see in a racing scenario, and trying to keep it as realistic as possible. You know, it's pretty hard to judge when you're in an enclosed cabin with no wind in your face, you know, exactly the sort of angles and speeds you should be doing. You could have the target speeds of what you should be doing posted, but pretty much, you know, you just do it by feel, really, of what, you know, what performance you should be getting. You can always see the other boats, so you can monitor how the land is tracking behind it and get a sense of where you should be. It was really, really good for a bit of the pre-starting and just understanding what you put the other team, put the real boat under a bit of pressure of what they shouldn't be doing, and where they should and shouldn't hang out in the pre-start area. And so, you know, it's really, really good learnings. But until we actually started racing, there's a whole nother level again. But, you know, it's really good for a base foundation of for the communication on board the boat, and who's going to cover, who's going to talk about what, and where are the blind spots. So for all of the basics, and getting the time on distance right and some of the raw situations, it was really, really useful. But until you're actually up against another yacht with, you know, as we all found out, the dirty air from these boats is fairly significant, and it's hard to do that from a chase boat. It's hard to create dirty air. We can create plenty of turbulence for the foils, but not a lot of dirty air. So, you know, there's a lot of lessons that became more apparent once we actually started racing. And even though we did the World Series earlier, all of the teams, I think the more racing they did, and certainly in the light air, the more of a bigger deal the dirty air of the other boat became. Like, it's always a factor, obviously, in every boat you sail in. You learn to sail in an Optimus and you learn about dirty air. So it's something that's always there and is always going to be there. So it's no real surprise, but it's just the effect it has on a foiling boat is very, very dramatic. Whereas you'd be in your monohull and, you know, you come upright a little bit and your sail's flat, but you've got a bit of momentum and you can sort of make your way out of that dirty air or roll into a tack and maybe lose half a knot of speed out of a tack, because someone hit you, but obviously with a foiling boat, it's pretty dramatic difference in performance once you drop off the foils or have to sail, you know, 10 or 15 degrees wider to accelerate. So I think, you know, obviously we all know the dirty is there, but the effect of it on this type of boat, even more so than a catamaran, is dramatic. So that certainly had to factor into the racing as it went on more and more.
And
we'll go and
That dirty air seemed to stay around a lot longer than you would expect it to as well. I was watching it from here in Mallorca in the early hours of the morning, so difficult to tell, but it seemed like in the pre-start sometimes the boats would sail back through their own dirty air. Was that what was happening, or am I imagining that?
Yeah, no, for sure. It would be very tortured. The breeze was pretty, I guess, look, I'm not an aerodynamic expert, but, you know, putting a sailor's sort of practical head into the equation is, you can imagine you're distorting that air with the amount of riding moment these boats generate. You must be kind of really distorting that air a lot. And it's similar to why planes need so much time between takeoffs. It's not just to clear the runway, but planes are actually waiting for that dirty air to clear the runway. If there's not a lot of wind around, blowing that dirty air away. So you know, it does hang around, and yeah, it doesn't take much for these foiling boats, that dirty air, to really create a lot of mayhem. So yes, you would. In certain wind speeds, your exit angle out of a jibe was taking you directly through the dirty air that you'd only just left behind you. So that, especially in those light air jibes, sort of in a pre-start where you're not trying to sail downwind, you're just coming back at, you know, at 90 degrees. And then you really pass through that dirty air. Normally, in a normal downwind jibe scenario, your wind is always forward, so you don't go back through your own dirty air. It's just the boat behind to worry about that. So yeah, that's quite a different sort of concept from what we're used to. But yeah, the breeze is generally always forward downwind. It's just in that real marginal light air conditions that you end up passing back through your own dirty air. And certainly if there's two boats sailing next to each other and one of them jibes back through a double amount of gas, it's real hard work. Yeah.
So the time came for you to stop coaching and to stop practicing with them, and the boys had to go out and do it for themselves. During a typical race day, where was Ray Davis? Were you in the chase boat?
Yep. No, we do a lead up before the race, and obviously a little check in on the conditions that we're sailing in, and you know, a big part of it too is making sure you've giving yourself the best chance at having the right sails on board. So there's that mainsail call. So yeah, talking a lot with clouds, like I normally would at every regatta I do. So a good conversation with Roger Badham, and he was based in New Zealand. So we're getting as good a feeling as we could for the weather and the range and what we're expecting it to do. It's a bit tricky sometimes, the mainsail call, because by the time you would put a mainsail up, you're pretty much committed to that. There wasn't a lot of time between the races. So sometimes you're trying to have a conversation about, you know, which mainsails might not be good in the first race, but it'll be better in the second race, or vice versa. So that was always an interesting call that the teams had to make. And then obviously your jib call was relatively easy in the sense that you could do it quite late, just before the start, and you're just really worrying about that first beat. But even though, you know, you could make that decision quite late, we still didn't get it right every time. The wind was quite variable at times, but at least that one you could just push that decision right out to pretty much go with what you saw on the water and what you felt was going to happen with the forecast. So Yeah, that was sort of my main focus leading up to the start was, you know, before, obviously plenty of work before we left the dock and reviewing all the footage from the day before and trying to figure out what we thought the other teams might have a crack at as the racing went on and what sort of how the pre-starts might evolve. And then certainly as the heat came on, Prada more and more, you know, what they may or may not try to do in the pre-start. So plenty of discussion around that. And, yeah, just pretty much going through our regular process. It was amazing for us on the chase boat. It was just like another day sailing, and that was, you know, how we'd always tried to plan it. So, you know, you'd run to a pretty tight sort of timesheet on what we're trying to achieve. And even the last day of the cup, it just sort of felt like just another sailing day. So that was, we're just trying to keep those routines in place. And yeah, it's pretty straightforward really on the water for us. It was just another day on the water. But, you know, the thing with the debriefing side of it was pretty intense. There's a lot of amazing footage to go through and data to pour over. So, you know, we could drag that out into the wee hours of the night.
So you would debrief on the day, on the day, and then
yeah, we would. We'd just sort of come in and try to get that, smash that out, and then start the next day fresh. But I think each team does it their own way there. So yeah, it's a bit of a personal preference really for what each team likes. I don't think there's a real set sort of perfect roadmap for that. You just got to talk about what each team prefers to do. And for us, yeah, we like that option.
Yeah, you're a very self-contained unit at the best of times. And once the cup was up, I heard it. I think Shirley Robertson described it as, you know, a kind of fortress. You guys built a fortress around yourselves. There were no external influences on you at all, really. Is that the way you like to do it?
Oh, it's bloody hard to get out of that place once you're in. It's like a jail. So, yeah, no, it's we're not sure which way the fortress works, but, yeah, it's hard to get out. But, yeah, it was a little bit like that. It was just, the, you know, yeah, we're a very tight team for sure, and I guess we're like that in the tents and that we've been in before, but, you know, the VEC, the building, the Viaduct Event Centre building that we're incredibly fortunate to be able to use was a pretty imposing-looking building, which, yeah, was a whole nother level to anything we've had before. So, yeah, that probably made it all pretty imposing as well. But, yeah, we're incredibly lucky with the facility we had there, and yeah, we didn't need to leave the place. So once we were in there, we had all our sail lofts and meetings and rooms and everything in-house there, where some of the other teams were sort of shuffling around a little bit to make it work. But yeah, no, we're a very tight team and pretty much would venture out for a coffee and that was pretty much it.
When the racing did begin, Ray, it got to the point where it was, you guys were trading races with the Italians until it got to 3-3. Now, from the outside, I'm not sure whether the spectators were surprised by that. I think we were delighted by how close it was because it made for a great spectacle, made for great tension. But from your side, were you expecting to be further ahead in the match by then or in more control, or was this what you were expecting all along?
Oh, we're certainly hoping to be to be further ahead, but no, we knew it was going to be all on, and we knew that they were going to be probably a bit more race ready than we were going to be. That was probably an advantage they were always going to bring into the match with that format of us not being involved in the Challenger Series was always going to hurt us at some point. It probably meant we could do our own thing a little bit more and push our design and performance of the boat for longer, not being involved. But the trade-off was, you know, missing out on the racing, obviously. So, yeah, you know, there's some pretty pretty steep learning curve there once we actually got into the racing with some of those dynamics. And, you know, the guys did a pretty good job of digging themselves out of some holes there as well. It could have been worse than 3-3 for a while there. And then at that point, you know, we were definitely getting better every day. And that's all you hope for with a team in those situations. And, yeah, we were learning and improving and sailing the boat better. So it wasn't any one thing that suddenly clicked. There's, you know, a whole myriad of various, you know, areas we were working on. And, you know, across that range of performance criteria, we were making pretty significant gains, you know, the way we're manoeuvring the boat and dealing with the starting and tactics around the course and boat on boat management. And so it was really, really pleasing to see, you know, the gain. And in the end, you know, we had to sail our boat with to its potential and try not to get too involved with the other guys. And, you know, they were pretty much trying to do the same to us and sail to their potential and hurt us as much as they could. But I think as we saw in the end that, you know, we had a fairly, well, you know, fairly significant speed edge, but not massive, certainly by no means enough to dig you out of a hole every time. So we had to sail really, really well. As with any high-performance boat, you know, you got to go the right way first and foremost. And, you know, it was really, really pleasing to see the guys, when the pressure came on, they were sailing better. And, you know, they've proven that through all their Olympic campaigns from all of those guys, the Olympic sailors on the boat, that is their strength, is they actually tend to sail a bit better under a bit of pressure. And certainly you need that on your side in the America's Cup. You always have to win that last race, not the first one. Look, really, really pleasing to see that rate of gain.
And it seemed early on in those first few races that there were two modes with the boats, certainly upwind. The Italians had this really, really useful high mode where they could stay quite fast, whereas you guys were more bow down but potentially faster through the water. Did that change over the? I mean, first of all, did I get that right? And secondly, did that change over the rest of the series?
No, that's a good observation for sure. You know, their foil, their package sails and foil package was more tailored for that higher mode, whereas ours is probably more tailored for a faster mode. So, yeah, inherently, when you look at the two foils and sails, it's sort of, yeah, you know, fairly obvious from the Cup team's perspective that the boats were motored differently, and they did a really good job of optimising their strengths in those races that they bet us. And, you know, with match racing, to be able to hang in a high mode and live to a boundary or get rid of someone on your hip is a very, very strong, you know, bow to have in your quiver. Really, really strong. But, you know, the other nice bow to have in your quiver is to be able to go fast. And, you know, I think we've just seen the trade-offs. You can't really have everything. So, you know, once you can play to your strength, you know, that's absolutely key. And, you know, those guys did a really, really good job of playing to their strength. And, you know, a lot of, you know, even in the pre-starting, that high, slow mode can be very, very useful as well. So it can make it easier to deal with that pre-start scenario too. And, yeah, that's something that the teams will all have to weigh up next time, is where do you position your boat on that performance curve? Do you want flat-out ultimate speed, or do you want more sort of moding capability? So, yeah, that's a trade-off that teams will have to make in the future as well. You're dead right. That was certainly the differences between the two boats.
Would you imagine in the future the race courses might be slightly different in terms of the limitations of the boundary, because that did seem to make it a little one-dimensional at times in those early races? Whoever would got control after that, after the left-hand boundary off the start, did pretty well.
Yeah. Now, look, that's a really good. That's a really good question, really good point, and one for plenty of debate as well. And I think part of the equation is the conditions on the day, which potentially affects the optimum race course that you'd have. For example, if you didn't change anything with the type of course we had, and we had a puffy sou'wester on that course C, which we sort of, that's where we thought we were going to do most of the racing. That width and everything is pretty ideal when things are changing a bit more. But as soon as we're into more of those steady kind of sea breeze or sort of somewhat steady, sort of 9 to 11 knot conditions, then it does get pretty one-dimensional, or in the real light here as well. So it's definitely an area to keep thinking about and address going forward. There's certainly a lot of options on the table there. We'll just have to have a good think about how we can make the really exciting racing in light air as well, and then also have it safe and breathe. And I think, you know, one of the big gains we've seen in sailing in the last few years is the stadium type racing, to bring it racing in close to shore, and you know, that's pretty much essential, I think, is LGP type racing and America's Cup, and even the TP52s and RCs are bringing their racing in close, and obviously the Olympic classes are getting in close to shore, and I think that, you know, makes it exciting. The best sailors still win at the end of the day. So I think we just got to, you know, keep factoring all those considerations. But yeah, we're certainly open-minded to ideas on how we can make the racing more exciting.
Well, certainly by the end of the series, the final two races were pretty exciting. The race that put you into match point, I thought was a classic full-on barroom brawl of a match race, with, you know, boats being sailed outside the ley lines to the leeward gate, and all the good stuff that we know from traditional match racing. That must have been really rewarding for you, who kind of was a champion of this AC75 concept.
Yeah, no, absolutely. That was probably a highlight for myself as well, to see that type of racing happening with lead changes and, you know, dramatic different modes being sailed and really trying to control your opponent. And then it just not being over until the end. At the end of the day, you know, wind shifts are really important. And so, you know, it's actually, I don't know, I think it's almost more exciting when it is in the puffier, shiftier conditions, because just the, you know, gains and losses are so dramatic. So I think that's almost turning into probably something you're aiming to, you know, traditionally that has not been what you're striving for in these type of races. But certainly you're dead right, that second to last race there had it all going on, a little bit more breeze and shifts, and yeah, the start, the luffing, the squeezing the guy off your hip, the herding them off to one side of the course, and then the luff on the run. All on. So, yeah, hopefully we see more and more of that in the future.
Absolutely right. Now, you guys went on, obviously, to close it out, 7-3. The Cup remains with Emirates Team New Zealand. What was the reaction locally like? I mean, we obviously saw the crowds, we saw the champagne celebrations on the stage, and the everybody passing the cup around. But what's it been like in the days since then? It's been a little while. What's the reaction been like in New Zealand?
Yeah, look, during the America's Cup, and it was just absolutely overwhelming. As we were expecting New Zealand and Auckland to rise to the occasion, they certainly did. It was absolutely phenomenal. Probably a bit of a shame we didn't have more racing in on that stadium course, where we could have had the land viewpoints packed as well. But the number of boats on the water was pretty phenomenal. And certainly when we came back into the viaduct at the end of racing, the number of people on shore was phenomenal, absolutely heaving. You know, obviously we don't see that much these days within sport around the world, but yeah, New Zealand's been in a very fortunate, unique situation to be able to manage that in our little wee island down here. And, you know, we really made the most of it. Aucklanders were, and New Zealanders certainly got into that party atmosphere, and yeah, and I certainly made the most of it. And obviously it was such a shame to not have the event that we were all hoping, with the super yachts attending and the international tourism coming down for the event. So, you know, it's pretty exciting in the future with, you know, the potential amount of tourism that can, that, you know, I think everyone will be itching to go to events in the future when we get out of this situation. So yeah, no, it was just remarkable to have the racing here in New Zealand, the hometown, just getting right in behind it.
And it sounds as if you and the rest of the team, other people I've spoken to within the team, it just seems like you've rolled straight into another campaign now that almost is the defence is on again, isn't it?
Yeah, well, look, it's always really, really tough as soon as a cup finishes, whether you're winning or losing, because there's never enough work for everyone just to roll over and keep going. So this particular phase in every America's Cup cycle for every team is always pretty challenging, because you don't really tend to leave much on the table. You know, going into the racing, you're financially are spent and the people are spent. So really, I think obviously it's a time where everyone needs to have a break and have a breath and regroup and rethink about what they want to do with the next few years of their life and shake themselves off. And then doesn't tend to normally take very long before everyone realises they want to do it again. And then you start getting back into it. But generally, pretty much everyone needs a change initially. And, you know, some people have to roll on. The big wheel's got to keep turning, and there's a lot of conversations to be had at the team at the moment with people and with the future planning. So, yeah, there'll be a small team there that are really active. And then, you know, most of the team are... You know, able to have a bit of a breather at the moment.
Now, I deliberately haven't asked you anything about the future of the Cup, because I know it's top secret and it's under discussion and it's not decided. But what can you tell us about the timescales in which we might start to be able to hear about stuff? Are we talking a long time or a reasonably short time before we might have a...
Yeah, no, I think it's pretty common. No, there's a negotiation period with New Zealand that we're working through at the moment. So until that's all happened, that's the first stage, and there's still a few months of that ahead of us. So until that's happened, that's the most important date. And then after that point, well, then it's kind of wide open to, you know, to based on obviously which summer the event is in, and then you sort of work back from there. So yeah, so there's all sorts of options out there, but we just got to try to figure out what's the best one and what's actually doable in this climate as well. It's all a little bit tricky, but you know, the intent is there from a lot of people to keep it all rolling. It's a remarkable event, and you know, it's fantastic to see all of these other teams are itching to go again as well. So, you know, couldn't really be more positive. From, you know, historically, it's always been pretty wobbly at this point, but it's probably stronger than it's been in quite a few years.
Well, that's great to hear, and it's probably a great place for us to stop our conversation. I guess while we're waiting for these few months for some news about the next cup, we can go back to all the YouTube videos of this one and watch the onboard stuff. That's been my favourite thing to do, is watch the onboard and listen to the audio from each of the teams sailing, because some really good insights in all of that.
Oh, no, look, I think it's been a remarkable, that on water, the footage, and yeah, you can just keep pouring over it. It's you know, it's remarkable for everyone to be able to dive into it, keep learning more and more about the level of racing and communication and what was going on with these boats. And you know, the broadcast team did a pretty remarkable job bringing it to the masses. And you know, that's what our sport has to do to survive. And yeah, looks like it's going okay.
Well, it's great to have talked to you, Ray. Thank you so much for the insight. It's been fascinating to get an inside view now. This, at least the 36th Cup is over. So for now, Ray Davies, thanks so much.
Thanks for your time, Justin. No problem.
Well, that's it for this final episode of the Yacht Racing Podcast Extra for March 2021. Many thanks to Ray Davies for taking the time to speak to me, and also thanks as ever to you for all subscribing and listening wherever you are around the world. I'll be back soon with the first exclusive member-only episode of our April 2021 series, when I'll be speaking to French solo skipper Charlie Dallin, who this January finished first on the water at his first attempt at the Vendée Globe non-stop single-handed around the world race. Stay tuned for that one, and until then, I'll just say bye for now.